From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm David Watts Barton, sitting in for Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, Mark Twain's little-known formative years on the north shore of Lake Tahoe and this week's edition of Sound Advice. But first, medical marijuana has become big business all over California since it was made quasi-legal by voters 5 years ago. This is especially true in Sacramento, which has dozens of dispensaries operating in the city and the county. However, marijuana is still considered a Class 1 drug, equal in the eyes of the federal government to heroin and crack cocaine. And after issuing a Department of Justice directive saying that the federal government would not pursue dispensaries, this summer the Obama administration has decided to crack down on the dispensaries. Joining me are people on two sides of the issue. First, Benjamin Wagner is a U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of U.S., which includes the Sacramento area. He is charged with enforcing the federal law, and his lawyers have begun the process of suing dispensaries in the Sacramento area. Benjamin Wagner, welcome to Insight.
Thank you, David. Thanks for having me.
Let me get this all straight, too, because what people are saying, well, there's this crackdown. What is actually happening? What are you guys doing?
Well, let me correct one of the statements that you just made, David.
Okay.
There was a memo issued back in 2009 right. about the department's strategy concerning marijuana in states like California, where medical marijuana is legal in some form.
Right.
The department has never said that it was not going to sue dispensaries, that it was not going to enforce dispensaries. In fact, we've been prosecuting people for years. There are people serving federal prison times right now that we've prosecuted for cases that we've brought within the last few years.
Mm-hmm.
So, in fact, there's much less change than some people have, I think, portrayed. It's been our policy in the Department of Justice for quite a while that we are not about medicine. We're not pursuing sick people. That's not what our interest is. We're interested in pursuing people who are trafficking marijuana, sending it across state lines, making millions of dollars, commercial operations. And that really has not been a change. The only thing that has caught a lot of attention recently is we've made a public statement. The four U.S. attorneys came together to talk about our effort to enhance enforcement in this area. But the law has been the law, and the Department of Justice policy has really been very consistent throughout this period.
Okay, and as I think most people who've been following the issue know, there are all different layers or levels of this. There is still there are the people who are growing for dispensaries and dispensaries that are operating as strict nonprofits, and then there are other people who have been sort of using this as protection for trafficking in marijuana the way they always have. You indicted some people a few weeks ago, as I recall, who were bragging online about making a lot of money. And what's that case? Did that case sort of trigger this, or is that separate from this?
We've brought a number of cases over the last few months, and all of the cases that we have brought and the ones that we are interested in pursuing are large commercial operations, people who are making huge amounts of money. As a for example, one of the cases that we charged a couple of weeks ago were three individuals down in Fresno and Madera counties who were growing large amounts of marijuana. They claimed they were doing it for medical purposes. They had medical recommendations. Some of those, of course, didn't pan out, as is often the case. But what the investigation indicated is they were sending marijuana all over the country to packages to Texas and Massachusetts mm-hmm. and Connecticut. And bank records uncovered during the investigation showed that they'd received nearly $3 million in cash deposits into their accounts, but not in California, in Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just mm-hmm. old-fashioned trafficking using the trappings of state law. And these commercial operations, these folks who are really in it for the money, not to help sick people, a lot of them, call their customers patients, but really it's just a money-making operation. And that has not been legal ever in the United States, and it still isn't.
Mm-hmm. Also joining us is Max Del Real, who is a lobbyist who works with California Capital Solutions. And you work specifically with local dispensaries, correct?
I do, David. Great to be here.
And what's your take on what's happening right now?
Well, I want to first thank NPR and Mr. Wagner for this opportunity to discuss a very important issue, an issue that has ramifications not just here in the Sacramento region, but across the state of California, if not across America. We have a constitutional crisis on our hands today. I'm not an attorney. I can't give legal advice. My credentials are focused on state law and, more importantly, local control. And I'm talking about policies that have been created by municipalities like the city of Sacramento, real cities taking real time to try to interpret a very complicated issue. Today, the federal government of the United States of America says that marijuana, which I don't even use the term, medical cannabis has no medicinal value whatsoever to qualified patients who choose the alternative drug. I'm not a doctor. I cannot speak towards one's decision to choose medical cannabis, but here's what I know. We have a situation today where cities are creating opportunities for these collectives and cooperatives recognized by the state of California as nonprofits. My clients have paperwork from the Secretary of State that says they are a legal, lawful, nonprofit business. My clients hang proudly on their wall a Board of Equalization seller's permit paying taxes to the state of California. I have paperwork in front of me here that says that medical cannabis as an industry in California generates over $1.3 billion in legal transactions. The state of California, through the BOE, sees $105 million annually. That money is going to law enforcement. That money is going to public projects. And at the end of the day, it's going back to California. We have a situation right now where we're at a crossroads. America is asking a serious question. Should states be allowed to create their own laws governing the will of their own people?
Okay, well, let's ask that question to Benjamin Wagner from the U.S. Attorney's Office. It seems to me that you're speaking in much more narrow terms about particular people who are using this law, the medical marijuana law, as cover for doing something that remains illegal, correct?
That's right. I agree with Mr. Del Real that this is a serious issue for debate, that there's lots of policy discussions that can be had about this, and it's something that, there is a difference between state and federal law. My role is to enforce federal law, and federal law has been consistent in this area, for decades. Mm-hmm. And what we're interested in is preventing abuses where people are making millions of dollars. I agree with Mr. Del Real that this is a big money-making industry in California, no doubt about it. Mm-hmm. But if the money is being made just not to help sick people, but simply to sell marijuana to whoever wants to get high, to a lot of young people, that's just not acceptable under federal law. It never has been. And my job is to enforce federal law, and I'll continue to do it.
Now, the response among people I know and in the media has been all over the place. But a lot of people have talked about the Obama administration, and there was this directive in 2009 that they were going to sort of take a hands-off approach to this. And it sounds to me that you're saying that you still are taking a hands-off approach to the people who are following the law.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you raised that, because one of the reasons that we had this press conference last week to talk about our enforcement efforts is to try to clear up the misperception that has been out there about the policy that was announced back in 2009. And frankly, I think the policy was pretty clear, but I think people who actually read the policy would see that it's pretty clear. But there was a lot of misperception about it, and I think some of it, frankly, was deliberately created by some people in the marijuana industry because they wanted to convince people that this is not a serious violation of federal law. You don't have to worry about the feds. What the policy said was that we were not, as a matter of prosecutorial discretion, we were not going to target our resources against people who were sick, genuinely sick, individuals who were using medical marijuana for their own care. But the policy was also very clear that large commercial operations, those kinds of things, remain illegal, that enforcing the Controlled Substances Act in all states was a core priority of the department. In June of this year, a new memo was issued which further clarified the policy, just to drive home the point that what the policy is, was, has been, will be, is about targeting large commercial operations. But it was never the department's policy to have a hands-off, toward marijuana stores. Mm-hmm. The policy was, we're not going to target sick people. It's never been a hands-off policy toward large commercial operations. And that's what we're focusing our enforcement efforts on.
I'm curious still about the genesis of this. My understanding is there are four districts of the federal the U.S. attorney in the state of California.
That's right.
And that there are more problems in the two southern districts or the than up here? Or how does
no,
where I, did this come from? I've heard that it came from the southern district. but I'm...
No, this is an issue that all of us have been concerned about in all of our districts, all four of us in California, and frankly, a lot of U.S. attorneys who are in similar states around the country that have this issue of
which there are 16, right?
Of which there are 16, right. Right. And the different states are different. There are different laws. Some are extremely lax. I mean, California, I think, is on one end of the spectrum in terms of having virtually an unregulated free-for-all. And that's what we've got, is just marijuana stores sort of breaking out on every corner, selling to whoever they want with very little control. Other states have a very strictly controlled system in which only the state itself, there's no profit involved because only the state itself can control the, mm-hmm. the sale and distribution of marijuana. So there's a lot of different states with different issues. But the U.S. attorneys, a lot of them from these states have been talking about this issue for quite some time because these various laws are at variance with federal law, mm-hmm. and our jobs as prosecutors to enforce the law. Similarly, here in California, the four of us have been talking about this issue. We've been coordinating. Our districts are different. We have different sort of resource issues, and U.S. attorneys make individual charging decisions in different districts. But it didn't originate with any particular U.S. attorney. It's just something that we've all been concerned about, and we all wanted to try to send a message that people who are engaged in large-scale commercial operations in marijuana do have a real risk of federal prosecution or federal forfeiture actions.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about medical marijuana and new moves by the U.S. attorney to crack down on some of the large growers, at the very least, with Benjamin Wagner and also with Max Del Real. Max, you talked in first about this being a constitutional issue.
Yes.
Nationwide. But the federal law is what the federal law is, and we have an election next year, and things are very unlikely to change, at least in the next year and a half. What do you see this in terms of local dispensaries and how this is being applied here in town? Because my understanding is that you sent out letters to 16 local dispensaries, and you haven't talked to everybody. I'm addressing Benjamin Wagner again, sorry.
We've sent out a number to, we haven't talked about the exact number that we've sent out, but we've sent out letters to marijuana stores, but also to landowners where there are mm-hmm. large grows on the valley floor in about seven counties in the Eastern District of California.
Okay, landowners, not just landlords of dispensaries.
Right.
Oh, okay.
Right.
Max, back to you.
Well, I want to ground the conversation in our backyard because it's important to recognize a couple things. Number one, California is the seventh largest economy in the world. We're a nation state, people. Right. Number mm-hmm. one, our influence across America is real. When we make a ripple in California, it becomes a tidal wave when it reaches the East Coast. We have an opportunity, I believe, to work together, the federal government here in Sacramento, Mr. Wagner, and the medical cannabis industry that welcomes regulations, that welcomes transparency, that welcomes partnerships. I think it's important to clarify one thing. I'm a medical cannabis lobbyist. I'm not a marijuana lobbyist. I'm a healthcare advocate. Mm-hmm. I support the laws, and my clients follow the laws of the state of California. I have in my hand a draft guidelines prepared by the AG's office, Attorney General Harris, who is adopting and adapting new regulations on the backs of the AG guidelines prepared by our former Attorney General, who is now the governor, Brown today, to create specific regulations that not just follow state law, but can work with the federal mandates. I understand that Mr. Wagner's hands are tied on the issue of a Schedule I drug. A Schedule I drug is a threat to a society, and it also, according to the federal law, says there's no medicinal value. I have studies paid for by California taxpayers that came out of University of San Diego that say there is great medical value to cannabis as an alternative medicine. Here's my concern. I have in my hand a letter that was sent by Mr. Wagner's office to a licensed dispensary collective in Sacramento. It was sent to his landlord, and it essentially says that this operation is breaking the law. And we encourage you, as the U.S. Attorney's Office in Sacramento, to abandon your tenant, to look past the laws of California, to look past the seller's permit to the Board of Equalization, to look past the fact that a number of these collectives are endorsed by our chief, local Chief Brazil here in the city of Sacramento, to look past the fact that many of these collectives have give back programs to youth groups, to local hospitals, to senior programs, to libraries, to look past the facts and, in fact, go backwards in time.
Okay, and I want to let Mr. Wagner respond to that. But first, you understand the laws as they stand now, and what he's saying is that they're enforcing the laws. Do you support the U.S. Attorney's Department, this letter aside, supporting the laws?
Here's what the medical cannabis industry in California supports. We support regulations. We support the federal government going after the bad actors. In these economic times, and with limited resources, I think it's important to go after the people that are breaking the law, that are hurting our communities, mm-hmm. the cartels, and even the organized crime networks that exist. And we know that many of these organizations, many of these criminals exist in Southern California. It becomes preposterous, in my opinion, to threaten good people, good Americans, good Californians who are endorsed by the city of Sacramento, who are endorsed by the Sacramento Metro Chamber, who are endorsed by UC Medical Center, who are endorsed by their community groups and the right. Planning Commission. I think we have a situation that cannot be solved here at this table. I think the problem needs to be solved at the state legislature. I think it needs to be solved in the halls of Congress. And then, once we solve the problem, we can go back to working together on more important issues.
Well, and I think we can all agree that this is not going to be solved here. But Mr. Wagner, I wanted you to be able to respond to that as far as this particular dispensary that you're talking about, because you're saying that you're going after big growers and illegal operations, and Max Del Real is saying that you're going after people who are conforming to the law and who are endorsed by different respectable organizations.
Well, I think we're not going to agree on that, except the point that he made, which I do agree with, that obviously we're not going to solve the problem here, mm-hmm. that there is a need both at the state level and the federal level to address this issue legislatively. I'm not a policymaker. I'm not a legislator. I don't have an opinion on that. My job is to enforce the law,
right.
And the federal law in this area is pretty clear. My issue, though, is that a lot of the marijuana stores out there that are selling marijuana to people are claiming that they are just selling to sick people, and they're not. I mean, a lot of the cases that we have, we know from the surveillance, we know from records that have been analyzed from seized dispensaries, that a teeny percentage of the customers are people with serious illnesses like cancer or glaucoma or AIDS or something of that nature. The vast majority are young men who want marijuana, who are claiming things like sleeplessness, anxiety, things like that. So, that is just not a legal exercise under federal law, and my job is to enforce federal law, and I'm going to continue to do it.
All right. Well, we could talk about this for the rest of the hour and probably then some, and there are a lot of other people who'd like to have their say in it, but we're going to have to stop right there. Benjamin Wanger, U.S. Attorney, and Max Del Real, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you, David. Thank you, Max.
Thank you, David. Appreciate it.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, Mark Twain's formative years living on North Lake Tahoe's shore. Listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm David Watts Barton. Insight is also online. Joining us to tell us more is senior producer Jen Picard.
Hi,
hey, Jen.
Good morning, David. So we just heard some more details on the federal crackdown of medical marijuana dispensaries in California, and we'd like to know what you think about it. Send an email to insight@capradio.org or comment on our Facebook page, Insight at Capital Public Radio. And tomorrow we'll be talking with Scott Thompson and Kevin McDonald, two members of the Canadian comedy troupe Kids in the Hall. They're performing a set of solo and duo comedy acts this weekend at the Punchline in Sacramento. If you have any questions for Scott or Kevin or want to let us know what your favorite Kids in the Hall sketch is, comment on our Facebook page. That's Insight at Capital Public Radio, or you can send us an email to insight@capradio.org. You can also find out more information about all of our guests on today's show at www.capradio.org/insight.
Thanks, Jen.
You're welcome.
Mark Twain is most commonly associated with the Mississippi River, but all of those of us in Sacramento know that he was also here for a while, worked for the Sacramento Union, and what you may not have known is that he actually changed his name from Samuel Clemens to the name that made him famous while he was living at Tahoe's North Shore, at what is now called Incline Village. David Antonucci is a Tahoe resident who has written a new book about Twain called Fairest Picture, Mark Twain at Lake Tahoe, and he is in our studio to talk about what he's found out. Welcome to Insight.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
The headline in all this is, as I led in, is that he was Samuel Clemens when he went to Tahoe and he emerged Mark Twain. How did that happen?
Well, it was a process. He came as Sam Clemens with his brother Orion out to the Nevada Territory in August of 1861. And then about a month later, went up to Lake Tahoe to stake a timber claim, which turned out to be unsuccessful. And he tried a few other things, but eventually fell back on what was his primary talent, which was writing. And he began contributing articles under the name Josh to the local newspapers, the Virginia City Territorial Enterprise. And while he was working an open pit mine down near Mono Lake, he received a message from the editor of the Virginia City Territorial Enterprise that they wanted to hire him because here was a guy that could read and write very well and really enjoyed his funny articles. And so he walked from Mono Lake to Virginia City.
Really?
To report for work. And it was about that time he took on the pen name of Mark Twain, from Josh to Mark Twain, and as was the custom at that time. And from then on, he became Mark Twain.
He walked, okay, that's a little sidebar. He walked from Mono Lake to Virginia City. That is a very, very long walk.
Yes, it was, but that was the only form of transportation he had. He also walked from Carson City to Lake Tahoe, which was about 12 miles. And that was the primary way he got around. And the walk from Mono Lake to Virginia City was done by moonlight in the evening to avoid the heat.
Wow. And Mark Twain is a navigation term on the Mississippi, right?
Right, right. It denotes safe water, the distance between dangerous water where you could run aground and safe water.
Okay.
You say Mark Twain. That's at least one explanation. There are many other explanations as to what it means and why he took that name and why he continued to use it.
And so he was gold mining, did you say, or silver mining down at Mono Lake?
I think it was gold and silver.
Gold and silver
at Mono Lake.
But then at Tahoe, he'd struck a timber claim.
Right, he tried to file for a timber claim at Lake Tahoe. What had happened by the time he got here, all the trees between Virginia City and Lake Tahoe had either been cut and sawed up into firewood or mine shoring, or had been claimed. And so in 1861, big time timber cutting had moved into the Tahoe Basin because it was the closest source. And so when he arrived, he was looking for something to do and met up with a fellow named John Kinney, and they formed a partnership, walked up to Lake Tahoe, and came out about somewhere around what is now Incline Village. They had been set up with friends who told them there was a boat there for them and actually a cache of food that had been stored at State Line Point. And so they rowed across the lake, across Crystal Bay, camped that night at State Line Point, and then the next day set out looking for a good place to file a timber claim, some flat land with some big trees, and they found it in Tahoe Vista, what is now Tahoe Vista. It was wilderness then, where they found trees that were up to 5 feet in diameter, and they filed their claim there. And as readers of Roughing It know, what eventually happened is the campfire at their timber claim got out of control, and he set fire to the forest. And the roughing it side of it was, I call the Hollywood version, where the trees are all burned up, and you imagine standing sticks of charcoal. But there was also a letter written at the same time to his mother where he explained what happened, and it was closer to the truth. It was a ground fire, which was normal and natural, and that he told his mother, yeah, well, I did cause this fire, but I'm going back next week to finish the timber claim and to get the land. So they could claim up to 320 acres.
I'm speaking with David Antonucci. He has a new book about Mark Twain and his life at Lake Tahoe called The Fairest Picture, Mark Twain at Lake Tahoe. Are there a lot of discrepancies between Twain's stories in books like Roughing It and the articles that he wrote and what you found actually happened?
Well, Roughing It is what I call creative nonfiction. It's loosely based on truth, but it has a lot of tall tales, exaggerations, and invented characters. So one of the things I had to do was sort through all that. The letters that he wrote as Sam Clemens, though, I treated as truthful, that he would not mislead his mother or his sister. Mm-hmm. And so that became like a reference point. And then I compared what was in Roughing It to what I knew about Lake Tahoe during that period to see if it struck a true chord or not. And then from there, I was able to get to what I consider a baseline of substantial fact, which then I was able to locate his timber claim on that basis, based on his descriptions of the trip over, where he camped, what the campsite looked like, how far he walked, etc.
So there weren't records like at a county recorder's or anybody?
No, well, as it turned out, when he went up to Lake Tahoe, they didn't know where the state line was. Mm-hmm. And so he thought he was in the Nevada Territory, which the maps at the time, which weren't very good, showed that where he was in Tahoe Vista was thought to be not in California, but in Nevada, because the California-Nevada state line had not been surveyed yet. Hmm. Turns out, while he was up there, the surveyors were there laying out the state line, and as it turned out, he was about 3 miles into California with his timber claim. And so I have speculated, there's no proof because there's no documents anywhere, and he never said what happened, that he went back to Carson City to file his papers for the timber claim, and they looked at the maps that had come in from the surveyors, and they said, ha, you're in California. No luck there. The land is not available in California. So nothing ever came of the timber claim.
And how did you're an environmental engineer?
Yes.
How did you happen upon these stories? How did you conceive an interest in Mark Twain being up there?
Mainly just trying to get to the facts. There's a lot of misinformation about Lake Tahoe that's published on the internet and elsewhere. And I had taken a history class at the community college there, and they assigned us a term paper. And so I decided I would figure out where Mark Twain was, because all the chambers of commerce claim Mark Twain slept here. And it was just a big myth at that time, but we knew he'd been here. So using science and history and literature, this book's a rare intersection of those three subject areas, I was able to determine exactly where he was and then corroborate that with the science that's actually mentioned in his books. While I say Roughing It is creative nonfiction, there were some things in there that he said that could only have been true in a certain area about Lake Tahoe. Hmm. And so using that information, for instance, he said, the rocks on the bottom of the lake are gray and white. So where does that happen at Lake Tahoe? And there's one place where that happens, and that is right there in Agate Bay, where white granite meets gray volcanic rock. And while you can't see the color of the rocks anymore because of the decline in clarity in Lake Tahoe, we know that from the geology that there were gray and white rocks on the bottom. So that was one of the ways I was able to pinpoint the location.
And you mentioned that the area around Virginia City, and I'm assuming all the way into that Carson Valley, had been largely deforested.
Yes, it was deforested.
What happened when the people who had all deforested that area discovered Lake Tahoe?
Well, big-time lumbering moved into Lake Tahoe in the mid to late 1860s, and by the mid-1890s, 95% of the forest had been cut and shipped either to the mines in Virginia City or to the construction of the Transcontinental Railroad. It's been said that the mines of Virginia City are the tomb of the forests of Tahoe.
And those forests have changed since then as a consequence?
Yes. Yeah, the forest is completely different today than it was then. The forest of Mark Twain's time, as I mentioned in the book, based on my research, was an old-growth forest. Trees were very large, 3 to 5 feet in diameter, primarily pine trees, Jeffrey pine, sugar pine, ponderosa pine, and it was well-spaced, large trees. It said that a man could ride a horse through the forest and at a gallop and not lose his hat, so well-spaced were the trees.
Wow.
And today we know that's not the case. The forest has come back because it was all cut at once. It's all come back with all the trees growing too close together. Primarily, one or two varieties predominate. And because of fire suppression, the fire threat is extremely high in the Tahoe Forest. Whereas the old-growth Tahoe Forest, it would burn periodically, naturally, mm-hmm. and it was a health-restoring fire. So Mark Twain's fire really did little or no damage. And probably helped the forest in that regard.
And that original forest was all the way around the lake and was all cut down?
About 95% of it.
Is there any remaining forest or area?
Yeah, there's a few spots where you can see what the trees were like, small groves that were either overlooked or they were owned by other people who would not allow the logging companies in.
And is it possible to go see them? I mean, are they pointed out in some way?
Yeah, there are. The Talak site on South Lake Tahoe near Camp Richardson is one such location. That property was owned by a guy named Lucky Baldwin, and he wouldn't allow the loggers onto his property. So there's some very large trees.
Is that the Fallen Leaf Lake area?
Yeah, between Fallen Leaf Lake and Lake Tahoe, there around Camp Richardson and where what they call the Talak Historic Site.
Oh, okay.
It's probably the best example of that, but there are little groves here and there in the backcountry where there are the large trees that were the type that Mark Twain saw when he was there.
All right. Well, David Antonucci, thanks so much for coming.
Okay, my pleasure.
His book is called Fairest Picture, Mark Twain at Lake Tahoe, and it is available all over the place, we hope.
Usual. Local bookstores first, if not Amazon.com.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, a reporter and her new book on her 30 years covering Central America. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm David Watts Barton. For more about the people and topics on our show, go to capradio.org/insight. Now it's time to find out what's happening in the news today with senior editor Alan Ray. He joins us from the newsroom. Right. Hey, Alan, what's up?
Well, good morning, David. You know that TV commercial that says, I fall and I can't get up?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So if we told you the banks and lenders had finally got the robo-signing scandal that played out in the residential mortgage markets, you might think that sounded like good news. Nope. The market apparently has fallen and can't get up. Now that we've got past robo-signing, the rate of foreclosures has ramped up again, and RealtyTrack now says the third quarter home foreclosure rate in California and in Sacramento jumped and will probably go up even higher in the fourth quarter. That story and much more, including how much Warren Buffett made last year. It was, seven, eight figures, something like that?
Yeah.
That on All Things Considered, beginning at 3:30 this afternoon on Capital Public Radio.
All right. Thanks, Alan.
My pleasure.
The part of Central America that was once the center of the Mayan civilization has been torn by civil war, oppressive regimes, indigenous uprisings, and archaeological digs. It is also home to some of the world's most vibrant, enduring indigenous cultures. Mary Jo McConaughey has covered the region for 30 years as a reporter and documentary producer for PBS and as a travel writer. Her new book, Maya Roads, chronicles her three decades covering the region, and it was recently named Book of the Month by National Geographic Traveler. Mary Jo McConaughey, welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
Now, who have you covered this region for? Have you mostly been as a reporter?
Yes, I covered it for Pacific News Service and did a lot of work for the Examiner and later for the Chronicle and a variety of U.S. newspapers and magazines like Time and Newsweek.
Mm-hmm. And do you live down there?
I did. I lived there for 11 years. In Guatemala, and before that, in El Salvador and Nicaragua.
And what is this your first book about the area?
It is. I've been in other people's books, that is, anthologies and collections, but this is the first one that I could fashion all by myself and write from beginning to end.
And it's called Maya Rhodes, and is it a? It's not a collection of your writing, though. It's a whole new book. Right?
No, it's a brand new book.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what drove you to after all this time? What got you to write Maya Rhodes?
You know, I saw a film recently by a friend Pam Yates. It's called Granito. It was at the Mill Valley Film Festival, and she has a line in there where she says, "Guatemala put its arms around my soul and wouldn't let go." And that's pretty much what happened to me in southern Mexico and Guatemala. It was such an engaging place and so rich and layered that I felt that as a reporter, I wasn't getting at certain things in dispatches of 650 words to 1,000. Mm-hmm. So I said, I'm going to go back to that beautiful rainforest and try to forget about some of the things I'd seen during the wars and just, you know, write a beautiful story. Well, of course, it wasn't that easy because the rainforest was a mirror of everything else in Central America, the good, the bad, and the ugly, as they say.
Mm-hmm. And what were some of those stories that you wanted to tell that you weren't able to tell as a reporter?
Yeah, I wanted to talk, first of all, about the exquisite beauty of the place that draws you and is really worth keeping. Now, there's also the population that was very, very attractive to me. That is, most of the people are poor and lead lives that are pretty difficult. And yet, especially the indigenous among them, they really haven't given up for 500 years since the conquest. And there have been periodic resistances, the latest of which was the Zapatista rebellion in southern Mexico. Mm-hmm. And the Maya in that region, I think, had a lot to say about living day to day and not observing the calendar, not observing time like we do, that it's all linear and what's the situation today is either going to get better or not. They look at things more in a cyclical way and have really kept their culture.
Well, we're hearing a lot about that with 2012 coming up next year. That's part of the Mayan calendar, isn't it?
That's right. Well, in fact, the Maya have three calendars. One is a 260-day calendar, and that one is really important to their priests and their diviners. And the other one is very much like our calendar, 360 days for the agricultural cycle. But the calendar you're referring to, David, is the 5,126-year calendar, which happens to end next year.
Ah, okay.
Uh-huh. And these period endings, as they call them, either 400 years or the different periods that they have, were always pretty big deals. We know from the classic Maya art and architecture and those beautiful stelae, those carved blocks mm-hmm. they left behind. So we think that this period ending is also special.
And when you say Maya and you use the word Maya in Maya Rhodes, the title of your book, we think of that, a lot of us tend to think of that as being, you know, 500 years ago, but that is the way that a lot of contemporary indigenous people still describe themselves, right?
Oh, absolutely. You know that the Maya have now recovered the same numbers they had right at the time of the conquest,
really?
Just by population growth. Uh-huh. They speak 29 different languages. There are 8 million of them, that's about the size of Switzerland, let's say. And 15% of that number of people live in the United States.
Wow.
Yeah, there's been a lot of immigration, especially since the wars there in the 80s and 90s, that you can say the typical migrant from down south now is an indigenous Maya young man coming up here to look for work, to send money back and support the families.
I'm speaking with Mary Jug McConaughey. She's the author of a new book, Maya Roads, and I should mention you'll be speaking at the Avid Reader on Broadway in Sacramento on Sunday night, correct?
That's right. And also in Davis, Sacramento's in the afternoon. That's from 2 to 4.
Okay.
Sure. And in Davis, at the Avid Reader at 7 on Friday night.
All right. Well, we got that out there then.
Great.
You mentioned the wars because you did cover, as you said, you were covering a lot of conflict during your time as a reporter. And one of the names that comes up in your book is actually a friend of mine and a name that a lot of people know, Will Lauder, who's from Davis and has been very involved in the sanctuary movement and in uncovering a lot of the mass graves in Guatemala. How does he figure into your work?
Will is a tremendous person, as you know, and coached at Davis for, 40, 50 years or something. And he'll be there tomorrow evening. In fact, this is co-sponsored by the Davis Religious Community for Sanctuary, a very vibrant activist group. Will was responsible for really getting two of the witnesses to turn state's evidence in one of the most egregious massacres in Guatemala history. Why did they do that? Because they trusted him. They trusted him, and he accompanied them the day that they gave testimony, when their families were spirited out of the country so that they couldn't be used to blackmail these witnesses, so they wouldn't change their minds. And then he accompanied them to the third country where they were given sanctuary. And I know all this because I was with him. And he was, he is a tremendous person, really a local treasure there in Davis.
Yes, he is. And he figures in your book, which is called Maya Roads. We've been speaking with Mary Jo McConaughey, and she will be at the Avid Reader at 2 o'clock on Sunday in Sacramento on Broadway, and then at 6 o'clock in Davis, correct?
7 p.m. tomorrow evening in Davis.
7 p.m. tomorrow evening, my apologies.
That's all right.
All right, well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. And by the way, David, MayaRoads.com has a lot more information about the book.
Terrific. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, this week's Sound Advice. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm David Watts Barton. It will be gorgeous in the valley and the foothills today, sunny with highs in the mid-80s. That'll be great weather to go check out the 2011 U.S. Masters Synchronized Swimming Championships in Roseville. It's also going to be clear tonight and sunny tomorrow with a slight cooling over the weekend. In Reno, it will be sunny with highs in the upper 70s, lower 70s for South Lake Tahoe. And if you're in that area, you might as well stick around for the Fall Beer Festival at Harrah's in Reno. That starts tomorrow. Every Thursday, we at Insight bring you Sound Advice, in which a local music expert shares some of their new discoveries in sound. This week, I'm joined by Nick Miller of the Sacramento News and Review, who has some music from an artist you've heard, as well as music from artists you've probably never even heard of. Nick, welcome to Insight.
Hey, good to see you again.
What have you got for us?
Let's start. This band's called Fantagram. The song's called Don't Move. The album comes out next month. They're playing Harlow's in Sacramento on November 1st, and it's electropop. Let's give it a listen.
All right. I was going to ask you what makes that electropop until the vocal came in, because it sounded like old Django pop to me at first.
It does. It's got this big kind of epic soulful hook, and then it does the whole Portishead thing and breaks it down, and then the female vocals come in. And I don't know, what do you think about that? Sometimes I worry that's so formulaic now, you know, 10 years after the advent of electropop, but I can't deny the power of the hook. You know, I kind of like it. It gets me in a good spirit.
I picture, when I heard that, I pictured somebody sitting over a laptop, though. Is that a band?
Yeah,
is that a band?
There are a two-piece live keyboards and synths, female vocals out of Sarasota Springs, New York. This is their third album. So they have a lot of, they're playing live instruments during their set. They have a lot of energy.
Oh, they are. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. And the next name we have is a familiar name. The only one that was familiar to me on the list, actually. And that's Bjork.
Yeah. Bjork dropped her new album this Tuesday. She was on All Songs Considered on NPR earlier this week. She put the album out on the iPad. And, so let's give the song a listen. We'll talk about that.
Okay. And that's Bjork from her new album, and that's the song Crystalline, with Nick Miller doing sound advice for this week. And you were showing me during that the iPad with all these patterns on it, and she's the original electropop person, I would
definitely
have to say.
Definitely. Yeah, if you buy the song for $1.99 on the iPad, you get to play this very kind of boring game where you fly around through tunnels and pick up crystals, and I'm really confused by it.
Okay.
As it should be with Bjork,
with
right?
With Bjork, yeah. It's she's meant to be confusing. Onward, Youth Lagoon.
Out of Idaho. He's kind of the indie darling of the moment. Whistling, soft, lo-fi sound. Let's give it a listen.
All right, this is Afternoon. And that's Youth Lagoon. Is that instrumental?
No, it has vocals, but they're going to be just kind of buried.
Uh-huh.
I always thought we should do this, David. We should start a band and sound really terrible and just whistle and have the hook that's the whistle. And I feel like every 2 years there's one of those songs that comes through and just breaks through in a big way. And they got an 8.4 on Pitchfork 2 weeks ago. And so he's kind of the next waves. He was actually here in Sacramento for a while recording at the Hangar.
Oh, really?
Okay. He did some B-side songs there, and he's a little, I don't know, he's probably 21, 22.
Uh-huh.
Great little kid, really shy, though.
Okay. All right. And then here's the next band you have is a name that I can't believe nobody has already taken.
Or should take, right?
Or should take, yes.
It's like, I don't know. You remember, you know, in like all those bands, like the radio, the TV. This band's called The Internet. They're part of the Odd Future troupe out of Los Angeles that just won the MTV Music Award for Best New Artist. But this is, they're calling it Experimental Soul.
Okay.
So here we go.
The Internet, and you said the song's called Love Song Minus One Minus Two.
Yeah, they put two songs on their website last week. Sometimes I worry though that experimental is just another word for kind of lazy production and mediocre
or electropop
or electropop. You're feeling it.
That sounded like electropop with a Lauryn Hill or a soul singer over
totally,
it.
Totally.
I liked it though. It was different than the other stuff. It had a more
it's
soulful
great,
kind of
right?
sound.
Right, because they're so rabidly offensive, the Odd Future gang. So for them to do something like that, it's kind of like, all right, you know.
Yeah, that was cool. All right, we have one more. What's that?
Another LA artist, Martin. His new album, Ghost People, it's kind of that bass music, post-dubstep sound. Let's give it a try.
All right. And that's Insight for today. I'm David Watts Barton. Jeffrey will be back tomorrow. Insight's assistant producer is James Morrison. Today's associate producer was Lynn Weaver. Our technical director is Mark Jones, and Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. Thank you for joining us.